University of Montana basketball player is kicked off the team. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about how a facility monitoring Medicare in the state could be shut down. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a Forest Service official about promoting diversity. The University of Montana dismissed one of its starting basketball players from the team today. Forward Spencer Coleman was the team's fourth leading rebounder and fifth in scoring. Coleman was cited in late May for driving under the influence. This followed a February arrest for speeding and being a minor in possession of alcohol. UM Athletic Director Kent Haslam says he can't discuss the specific reason for Coleman's dismissal, except that it followed a review under the Student Athlete Conduct Code.
A variety of things come into that decision, but yes, indeed, Spencer was dismissed, and we're sad to see him leave. He was a good contributor to our basketball program, and really a great young man, but just felt like that was necessary at this point.
UM Athletics have been under a microscope the last couple of years over sexual assault allegations in an ongoing NCAA investigation of the football team. Haslam says they continue to try to educate student athletes about the school's expectations.
We deal with 300-plus student athletes, and by far the vast majority of them are just wonderful young people and make great decisions all the time. And the challenge is you just continue to educate and you deal with those issues if they present themselves, but not get too bogged down and stay really focused on those positive things. So we're just going to keep moving forward, and you continue to set expectations and levels of responsibility, and I think those are things that teach great life lessons.
Spencer Coleman came to UM from Eugene, Oregon.
And in other news from around the state, Missoula-based Neptune Aviation has withdrawn its protest of the awarding of new federal air tanker contracts to other companies. CEO Ron Hooper says on the advice of attorneys, he can't comment on the withdrawal, but it comes in the wake of Colorado Senator Mark Udall's call for contractors to put lives before legal disputes. Neptune has been protesting the awarding of contracts for next-generation air tankers to five other companies, but not to Neptune, which has a long history of flying aircraft for the Forest Service. Turns out, only one of the seven large air tanker planes that were contracted by U.S. Forest Service to fight wildfires is doing so, now that the fire season has heated up. The other six state-of-the-art planes will still need to be certified to fly. The Forest Service says that process could take up to two more months. Hooper says his planes could be ready in half that time.
Our aircraft, we hope to have them through the IAB process within the next 30, 45 days. So our timeline is, if we had a contract, 30, 45 days, we could be ready.
The so-called next-generation turboprop and jet planes are bigger and faster than previous air tankers. The planes must be able to carry 3,000 gallons of slurry and fly at least 350 miles per hour. The only such plane flying right now belongs to 10 Tanker Air Carrier, a company in the process of moving its headquarters from Victorville, California to Wyoming. 10 Tanker's modified DC-10 passenger plane can drop up to 11,700 gallons of slurry at a time. The plane has been fighting recent wildfires in California and New Mexico. Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell says they'd made arrangements to bringing 8 air tankers down from Canada to fill the gap.
The problem with that, those resources are more expensive. A call when needed resource is going to cost us 1.5 to 2 times as much as the resources that we have on at the start of the season.
Tidwell says despite the fires in California and New Mexico, the season is generally off to a slow start compared to recent years.
An 18-year-old Columbia Falls man died and 3 people were injured in a head-on crash on U.S. Highway 2 northeast of Kalispell. Montana Highway Patrol Trooper Patrick Herman says a car crossed the center line and collided head-on with a minivan shortly after 10 a.m. today near Glacier Park International Airport. The Flathead County Sheriff's Office says driver Mercy Peterson died. Officials say a 17-year-old female passenger, also from Columbia Falls, underwent surgery and was listed in critical condition at a Kalispell hospital this afternoon. 2 men, ages 17 and 72, were in the minivan. They were taken to the Kalispell hospital for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries. The crash is still under investigation.
A crash in western North Dakota oil patch involving a van, a semi-trailer, and two other motorcycles has killed the drivers of the motorcycles. The Highway Patrol says the van was trying to pass the semi on State Highway 1804 near Trenton about 10 p.m. yesterday and collided head-on with two oncoming motorcycles. Authorities say the drivers of both motorcycles were thrown from the bikes. One driver landed in a ditch and the other was struck by the semi. The victims were not immediately identified. One was a 20-year-old man from Fairview, Montana, and the other an 18-year-old man from Roundup, Montana. The man from Fort Worth, Texas, who was driving the van, was taken to a Williston hospital with unspecified injuries. The driver of the semi from Alpine, Wyoming, was not hurt.
A 24-year-old Whitefish man has pleaded guilty to raping a 15-year-old babysitter in November 2011 in a case in which his estranged wife also was a defendant. The Daily Interlake reports Corey Hubble pleaded guilty to sexual intercourse without consent during a district court hearing on May 30th. Sentencing is set for August 29th. Both Hubble and 21-year-old Nadine Lyons were charged with providing the girl with marijuana and alcohol before performing sexual acts on her. The newspaper reports Lyon had also intended to plead guilty at an earlier hearing, but it was vacated and her trial is set for June 18th.
A student at Hellgate High School in Missoula was disciplined after being spotted across the street with a non-operational replica of a sniper rifle he made in welding class. School resource officer Jim Johnson tells the Missoulian it was a metal gun and didn't have a firing mechanism, but it looked real from a distance. Principal Lisa Hendricks says the gun was confiscated and the boy received an undisclosed punishment. Johnson responded to a call on the school radio yesterday afternoon from a teacher who spotted the boy across the street from the school with what appeared to be a large rifle. Johnson says once he got close enough, he could tell it wasn't real. It's against school policy to possess even a toy weapon on school grounds.
Glacier National Park rangers rescued a 23-year-old whitefish man who fell off his raft into the swift-moving Upper McDonald Creek, then cited him for boating in a closed area. Glacier officials say Park Dispatch received a report yesterday afternoon that a rafter was stranded on a rock in the middle of the creek. Park rangers rescued the man while the Flathead County Swift Water Rescue Team recovered his belongings downstream. The man was cited for boating in an area closed for the protection of nesting harlequin ducks. Researchers say about 25% of the known broods of harlequin ducks in Montana breed along Upper McDonald Creek. The park announced earlier this week that researchers had located a banded harlequin duck known to be at least 17 years old.
Montanans who lost their homes to foreclosure between 2008 and 2011 and filed a valid claim through the National Mortgage Settlement will receive a check this month for nearly $1,500. Attorney General Tim Fox announced the payments yesterday for claims involving Ally, formerly GMAC, Bank of America Corporation, Citi, J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, and Wells Fargo & Company. Checks totaling $2.5 million are being mailed to over 1,700 Montana residents. The payments come from a $1.5 billion national settlement over mortgage servicing abuse.
A Montana organization which monitors the quality of Medicare services faces the possibility of closure. The federal government is considering closing state-based facilities in exchange for regional ones as a cost-saving measure. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the organization's CEO believes they are worth the cost.
Mountain Pacific Quality Healthcare CEO Sarah Medley says her Helena-based company has been operating for 40 years. It's a private nonprofit, and it's what's known as a QIO, or Quality Improvement Organization. Right now, every state has one of these. She says QIOs keep track of the services given to patients of Medicare, the government healthcare service for the elderly.
Every time they receive medical care, that it's the best, safest care it can possibly be.
So this can range from making sure nursing homes are doing what they can to prevent pressure ulcers in their patients, or working with doctors on moving to electronic medical records, or even media campaigns trying to get Medicare patients to get flu shots. Medley says every 3 years, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examines the funding for these QIOs.
And so the government is considering cutting many of the state-based organizations like ours and replacing them with a few regional organizations across the country to see if those changes could result in cost savings.
Medley says it could result in her office closing down if Montana's regional facility was chosen in another state. That could mean a loss of about 100 jobs in her office. Medley believes a state-based approach allows the facilities to be much more responsive to their local communities.
One state might be focused on something like obesity, And another state might be more concerned with hospital infections because they have a high hospital infection rate.
She says Governor Steve Bullock has written a letter to U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius supporting her call to keep the quality improvement organizations state-based. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has not yet made a decision about the change. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Five of Montana's seven American Indian reservations don't report drunken driving convictions to the state. County prosecutors say the information void poses a safety risk for both repeat offenders and other drivers. Tribal justice systems have jurisdiction over misdemeanor crimes committed by Native Americans on reservations. Attorney General spokesman John Barnes says the state can't force tribal courts to share misdemeanor DUI convictions with the state motor vehicle division. Barnes says the only Flathead and Fort Peck reservations voluntarily share DUI conviction records. Those that withhold DUI records are the Blackfeet, Crow, Fort Belknap, Northern Cheyenne, and Rocky Boys Reservation. Glacier County Attorney Carolyn Bruckham says that means police don't know how many people with unreported DUIs who may need treatment are sharing the road with other drivers.
The Billings Funeral Home has been fined $3,000 and one of its employees reprimanded after the business cremated a body without proper authorization. The Montana Department of Labor and Industry also ordered Smith Funeral Chapels to pay $1,500 to reimburse the state's licensing board for the investigation. The Billings Gazette reports the disciplinary action stems from the 2008 death of a 92-year-old Red Lodge man. A friend who discovered the man's body told the mortician the man wanted to be cremated. The funeral home said it needed a family member to sign a document authorizing the cremation. The man's niece and nephew didn't object to the cremation, but didn't sign the form right away. Smith Funeral Chapel co-owner Jared Scherer says the cremation was performed before the authorization was signed.
The USDA's Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment says he believes there's strength in diversity. Butch Blazer's been touring Idaho and Montana to talk about a number of issues, including an effort to bring greater diversity to the ranks of the Department of Agriculture. In tonight's feature interview, Blazer, an enrolled member of Mexico's Mescalero Apache tribe, discusses the importance of workforce diversity. Blazer describes himself as an avid outdoorsman who enjoys hunting and skiing.
Having grown up there on the reservation, and my father worked for the tribe managing their ranching program early in my life. I spent my early years, 5, 6, 7 years old, out with him feeding cows and going hunting with him, and it was a phenomenal period in my life. In the discussions that I had with my father and many of my tribal elders, it just led me to began to think that in order to have this for my children and my children's children, I wanted to be a part of making sure that those resources were managed well, and immediately began thinking of going on to college and getting a degree and learning how to manage natural resources.
I know you're touring the region to discuss diversity efforts in the USDA, the Forest Service Division, I guess, in particular. And when I think of the Forest Service, I'll be honest with you, in my mind's eye, my impression is one of a largely white organization. Is that fair or not?
No, that's fair. But the good news is that it's recognizing the importance of diversity, the strength in diversity. And Secretary Vilsack, ever since he stepped into the position of being Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, has really pushed this very fact that there is tremendous strength in diversifying our workforce. The Forest Service has really embraced that. But I think you'll understand, as I do, no matter what organization you're talking about, cultural change takes time, and it's not easy. But the strategy that has been developed within the U.S. Forest Service, I work very closely with Chief Tidwell and his executive leadership. They have embraced this, and they're working hard to affect that change.
You said the strength in diversifying the workforce.
Yes.
What is that strength? What good comes of it?
Well, when you bring different entities together, it just brings new thoughts, new ideas, in how to address many of the issues that need to be addressed in regards to natural resource management in this country. I'm a good example of that. When Secretary Vilsack brought me in, being a tribal person, that brought a whole new perspective into USDA in working with all of the non-Indian folks that I work with. And it's not that federal agencies don't want to work with tribes, it's that they really don't know how to make the right connections. And so in bringing me into USDA, I'm helping them to make those connections, to share what I have learned over the years working with the tribal organizations, working with tribal leadership that I've worked with, giving those other mission areas within the department the opportunity to make those connections.
And when you say make connections, do you mean what, to tribal administrations, or do you mean a connection like some sort of a cultural connection, if you will?
Both. When you say tribal connection, within Indian country, you know, our political system is just like anyone else. It changes. Being able to figure out that dynamic, to figure out how to effectively stay in touch with the national tribal leadership, I'm helping them do that. There's an organization called the National Congress of American Indians, which many of our tribes and Alaska Native villages belong to, and making the connection to that organization in regards to issues that USDA are involved with is critical in order to make sure that our efforts in working with tribes, working within Indian country through the various programs that we have within USDA, we need to make that connection at that level. But just as important is making the connection with many of the support organizations, Indian tribal nonprofits that are out there, like the Intertribal Ag Council, the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society, the Intertribal Timber Council. These organizations are there to support tribal natural resource interests. And it's important, again, that USDA and all of our agencies within USDA are aware of those nonprofits, have strong conversations with them, again, to form the partnerships that are needed to support tribal government.
What is Ag doing? What is the Forest Service doing to diversify its workforce?
Parts of those strategies include going out, looking at recruiting in areas. In particular, I know the Forest Service is making a very strong effort of getting out into the more impoverished areas of rural America and working with groups to recruit people out of those areas into the workforce.
Why? What does that bring?
Well, again, it brings diversity, and it brings people into the organization that have never had that opportunity. We're going to do this in a way where we're not compromising the quality of our workforce. The people we're going to bring in are going to be of very high quality.
On your trip, you've been touring several programs such as the Society for American Indian Government Employees out in Spokane earlier this week. When you talk about this topic with them, what are you hearing? What are people saying?
The Society of American Indian Government Employees are Native American people that many of them have spent a career in working for the federal government as public servants. Many of them are just starting out. They're very passionate about being federal employees, the work that they've been able to do in regards to the various agencies that they work with. They're wanting to share that.
If I could switch gears on you just for a moment, it looks like it's going to be possibly another long, hot summer. Bark beetle problems throughout this part of the country. How concerned are you about the fire season that we may be facing here?
Oh, I'm very concerned because, again, you know, everyone knows that our budget situation in this country, we only have so much resource to deal with the issues that we're dealing with. And as our wildfire seasons continue to get worse, that detracts money away from the restoration activities, the non-fire activities that we need to be doing in our national forests. And that's very concerning to me.
500 fewer firefighters will be hired as a result of the sequester. That's about a 5% decline, yeah?
Yeah, you know, again, in sequestration, we're looking at a 5% reduction in funding. And I believe you're right. That's the figure that Chief Tidwell has been using in regards to across the U.S. Forest Service is a reduction in 500 firefighters. But again, we have some very, very strong partnerships with our local firefighting entities through our counties, through our state forestry programs, and with our tribes. And again, as resources get tighter and tighter, these partnerships that we have become more and more important. We're currently working on a national initiative. It's entitled the National Wildland Fire Cohesive Strategy. And basically, this strategy, we have brought together representatives of all of these main organizations, both federal, tribal, our urban community, our counties, everyone, and brought representatives of those groups together to talk about how we can bring the resources that we have and truly work together in a way that we've never done before in addressing wildfire in this country.
Butch Blazer is USDA's Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight calls for mostly clear skies. Lows will be in the upper 30s to mid 40s. Tomorrow expect mostly sunny skies. Highs will be in the 70s to lower 80s. Sunday also calls for mostly clear skies and highs will be in the 70s to lower 80s. For central Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will stick around 50 degrees. Tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies with highs between 65 and 70 degrees. Sunday will also be cloudy with highs between 70 and 75 degrees. And for southwest Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will range between 40 and 50 degrees. Tomorrow expects sunny skies with highs between 70 and 75 degrees, and Sunday calls for mostly clear skies with highs between 70 and 80 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Olivia Riuta.
With Memorial Day behind us and school vacation in full swing, summer is just beginning to hit its stride here in Montana. Just talking about it brings a smile to my face. Vacation, barbecue, family, camping, fireworks, roasting marshmallows, swimming, and this summer, comprehensive immigration reform. The season that seems to celebrate so many things American is perhaps the perfect time for our country to embark on an epic discussion of immigration reform. Here at Montana Women Vote, we support comprehensive, fair immigration reform, and the time to pass it is now. And as an organization, we often get to engage in discussions about difficult issues, but few conversations evoke the same reaction, in part because our identity as Americans is deep, it's complex, and imperfect. And that can be challenging. But as much as our conversation about immigration reform can divide us, I believe that there are actually a lot of things that we can agree on. We can probably agree that our communities and state are stronger when all families have the resources and support to thrive. So as we begin this immigration reform debate, first and foremost, we need to change our immigration system so that families can stay together. Between July 2010 and September 2012, over 105,000 parents of children who were citizens were deported, with almost 100,000 more excluded or left voluntarily. These are parents of kids who are citizens who have no option but to uproot their children from their community and leave the only life their kids have ever known. In fact, the long-term emotional and psychological effects of this kind of turmoil on kids is being studied to understand some of the consequences of our current immigration policies. And if the entire family is not uprooted, many families with mixed immigration status find that one parent may be deported, with the other parent staying in their community, trying to raise their kids. In 2008, there were 4 million kids living in mixed-status homes. Our immigration system is essentially creating single-parent households, despite two parents wanting desperately to stay together, to work hard, and build a strong future for their children. But then again, it's not just immigrant families that work to create a better future for their kids. It's the driver of so many of us. You might even say that it is one of the ways that we define ourselves as Americans. Unfortunately, the stories of families being torn apart are also American stories. They're Montana stories. And while we may have fewer immigrants than our neighbors, they are still deserving of dignity, respect, and fairness under the big sky. In fact, immigrants in Montana are significant to our communities and our economy. They are families. They're working hard in every community across our state. Just among Asian and Latinos in Montana, their purchasing power was almost $750 million last year. And in 2008, Latino voters in Montana accounted for 1.7% of our population, which doesn't sound like much, but with 8,000 votes, that's enough to swing a statewide election. Next week, this discussion of immigration reform will be center stage in the U.S. Senate, and Montana's senators Baucus and Tester will cast crucial votes. They have the opportunity to make our system more fair, transparent, secure, and more efficient. While the immigration reform bill is long and certainly complicated, the crux of the issue is this. The bill would allow families who have different immigration status or no status to correct that through a multi-year process so that parents and their children can participate in our communities without the fear of being separated by the immigration system. By no means a perfect bill, but a really important start for immigrant families. One of the big problems that we see in the bill are some of the proposed bans, which are upwards of 15 years for new documented immigrants. Bans from access to health care and other programs and services that help women and families. Arbitrary bans are just hurtful. And at the end of the day, our communities and our state are strongest when individuals and families have the tools, resources, and support to thrive. So before you really let yourself get into the thick of all things summer, let's make sure that we seize this opportunity to fix our broken immigration system. Call Senator Baucus and Senator Tester and let them know that you believe in dignity and fairness for all Montanans, regardless of their immigration status. Tell them that you are one more Montanan standing up for fair immigration reform. You can find contact information for our senators, as well as information about comprehensive immigration reform and why it matters to women and families at our website, MontanaWomenVote.org. I'm Olivia Riuta with Montana Women Vote. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a fabulous summer.
Olivia Riuta is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.